were just creeping up over the horizon, and I saw it was going to be a clear day. The first thing I wanted to do was find that river and wash up. Not that I'm a clean freak or anything, but the animal skins I was wearing weren't exactly cottony fresh. I'm not sure which smelled worse, me or my clothes. A quick splash of water would be a good thing. So I picked my way through the Malago village in search of the stream. The village was just waking up. Smoke drifted up from chimneys in all the huts. A few women scurried along carrying firewood. In the distance, I saw farmers already working out in the fields. I also saw a pretty depressing sight. A group of men trudged into the village on a path that led from the woods. I figured they were miners since they were covered with dirt, like the miners who had brought glaze to the transfer ceremony the day before. But these guys have been working all night? I then saw another group of miners pass them going in the other direction. I realized this was some sort of change and shift. The day crew was taking over for the night crew. As bleak as this scene was, it wasn't the depressing part. The thing that really hit me was that nobody talked. Nobody. They didn't even make eye contact with one another. They just went about their business, doing their work or their chores or whatever it is they probably do every single day, but with absolutely no human interaction. I guess it didn't surprise me. After what I had seen the day before, I realized that these people were prisoners. Kagan's army had stolen everything they could from them, including their souls. There was no joy in this place, no hope. They probably didn't want to make friends with anyone because they never knew who might be Kagan's next victim. So they kept to themselves, living in their own personal, tortured world. It feels kind of weird to admit it, but as I stood there watching these people going about their dreary lives, I started to cry. Normally I'm not a crying kind of guy. Yeah, a couple of times I got weepy during a movie when somebody's dog died or something, but this was different. This was real. I stood in the center of this village, and it was like I could feel a huge weight of sadness pressed down on me. The thing is, no matter how bad somebody's life gets, it can always get better. Things pass and life goes on. Like for me, as bad as things were for me right then, I had a shot at getting home. There was hope. But for these people, there was no escape. Their future was just as bleak as their present. This was their life. And the hopelessness of it brought tears to my eyes. For that one brief instant, I could feel their pain. But you know something? It didn't last long. If anything, it made me want to get out of there even more. Yeah, I felt bad for them, but it wasn't my problem. This struggle had been going on for a long time, and nothing I could do was going to change it. I had to worry about myself right now. So I wiped away the tears, put my head down, and started to look for the path that led to the river. I had only walked a few feet when somebody grabbed my shoulder and whirled me around.
Crabble nectar?
It was Figgis, the strange little guy who tried to sell me the sweater before. He was holding up a leather pouch that looked full of liquid.
Very delicious, very rare, only 4 quills.
I assumed quills were like dinger on money. Thanks, no, I said, and walked on. But Figgis jumped in front of me. This time he held out a thing that looked like a crude fanny pack that was woven from dried straw.
20 quills,
he announced, while tying it around his waist to demonstrate. Even if I wanted to buy it, I didn't have any quills, so this was a waste of time. I tried to push past him, but he blocked my way again.
10 quills, since you are new,
he offered. He could tell that I wasn't interested. But he was desperate to make a sale, so he quickly yanked off one of the 10 rings that he wore on his fingers.
2 quills,
he shouted. I'm sorry, dude. I don't have any quills, I said. This guy seemed to be all about cash, so I figured that telling him I didn't have any would make him back off. It didn't. He grabbed my arm and pulled me toward him so fast that I didn't have a chance to stop him. He leaned in close and whispered something in my ear like he was giving me some information of dire importance.
That is the way. It is the only way. Relin knows this.
I could feel his hot breath on my ear. He smelled like a goat. I wanted to retch.
Remember, Tack. Remember me.
He then let go and scampered off and disappeared into the activity of the village. That was weird. What was Tack? He spoke about it with such passion that it made me think it must be something pretty special. It was like he was tempting me with it. Maybe it was illegal, and he had to be careful about selling it. It also felt kind of weird that I understood what he was saying. The day before, his words made no sense. Now I heard them as if he were speaking English. But according to Osa, he wasn't speaking English. He was speaking the Dendron language, but I heard it as English. Still, there were some words that didn't translate into English, like quill and tack and crabble. I guess those are things that are special to Dendron, and therefore don't have an English translation. Whatever it was he was selling, I didn't want any. So I continued on toward the river. A path snaked out of the village in the opposite direction from the ocean. Since I hadn't been there yet, I figured it must be the way to the river. After walking about 100 yards through the forest, I began to hear the sound of rushing water. A few yards further along, I hit it. The path ended at the bank of a river that looked to be about 20 yards across. I knelt down on the bank and dipped my hand in. Yow! It was like sticking my hands into a bucket of ice. I'm sure it was fed by snowmelt from the mountain, and rivers fed by snowmelt are frigid. But I was feeling all crusty from sleeping in animal skins and breathing smoke from the fire, so cold or not, I had to get wet. I took a deep breath and splashed water on my face. Wow! It was like 1,000 needles stinging me, but it actually felt pretty good. I took a big gulp and swished out my mouth. I wished I had my toothbrush, but this would have to do. That's when I heard the crack of a broken branch. Somebody was nearby. I heard someone humming a sweet tune. It was coming from just a few yards away. I think under normal circumstances I would have turned and left, but something compelled me to investigate. Remember how I described the people of this village? There was no joy here. There was only the sad business of survival. So hearing a pleasant tune being hummed felt out of left field. It made me want to see who it was. As strange as this seems, knowing that one of the Malaga would actually want to hum a song made me feel that there might be some hope left in these people after all. I remember going on a hike with my dad once through a forest that had been recently destroyed by fire. We were surrounded by nothing but the burned and black remains of what had once been a wonderful green thicket. It was sad, until I saw that growing out from beneath a fallen log was a single green fern leaf. As horrible as the devastation was, this one leaf was proof that one day the forest would return to normal. Hearing this tune coming through the woods made me think of that single fern leaf, and I wanted to see who was singing it. So I quietly snuck through the brush toward the sound. When I pushed back the final branch between me and the singer, I saw that it wasn't one of the Malaga after all. It was Lore. She was kneeling on a rock with her back to me, washing out some clothes. I was disappointed at first, but this posed another interesting puzzle. As I told you, Lore is a hard case. I don't know much about the territory where she and Osa came from, but it didn't take a genius to figure out that these two were warriors. Osa had a calm way about her. She reminded me of one of those black belt guys who are so confident in their fighting abilities that they are actually gentle people. Of course, if you messed with them, they'd kick your ass. Lore, on the other hand, didn't have that calm thing going on. She seemed ready for a good ass-kicking all the time. Maybe it was because she was young and hadn't gotten that wisdom-comes-with-age thing. It didn't matter, though. All I knew was that she scared the hell out of me. But seeing her on this rock, with her hair undone and humming a sweet tune, seemed completely against character. Maybe there was a soft side to her that she kept hidden somewhere below all that macho stuff. Way below. She was facing away from me and had no idea I was there. Her long hair fell across her shoulders. It was deep black. And beautiful. Now, before you go thinking I was some kind of perv, watching her from the bushes, you gotta realize that I was stuck. If I made a sound, she'd turn and see me watching her and probably pick up her stick and start playing Bobby the Pinata Boy. I wouldn't blame her. My only hope was that she'd finish washing up and walk back along the river toward the path without ever knowing I was there. So I stood rock still, doing my best to look like a tree. After what felt like a lifetime, Lore stood up and started to braid her hair. And that's when I heard it. Another crack of a branch told me that somebody was walking up behind me. My heart pounded. I thought for sure that Lore would hear this, turn around and catch me standing there like a doofus. I also thought that whoever was behind me was about to see me doing a Peeping Tom number on Lore. But I was afraid to leave because Lore would surely catch me. None of these scenarios was very good. What I didn't realize was that there was another scenario that was worse than all the above.
"I've been looking for you, Pendragon,"
came a deep voice that made Lore turn quickly in surprise. I turned too, and what I saw made my knees buckle. Standing behind me was one of Kagan's knights. He towered over me, holding a spear in one hand and a rope in the other. The guy had me. In that instant, I felt sure that St. Dane, or Malos, or whatever he called himself, had sent this guy to bring me in, the same way they got Uncle Press. And I knew one other thing. I wasn't going to go easily. So before the knight could make a move, I made my own move. I turned and ran for the river. Lore didn't have time to react, and I made another snap decision. She was coming with me. As she scrambled to her feet, I launched myself into a full-on horizontal flying tackle. I hit her, and we both went sailing off the rock into the river.
Cold? You don't know cold until you jump into a river swollen from melted snow.
The only reason it wasn't frozen solid was because it was moving so fast. But the truth was, I didn't care. If this river could get us away from that night, it didn't matter to me if it froze the blood in my veins. I could always get warm later. We hit the river in a tumble of arms and legs. The water was flowing so fast that it swept us downriver and away from the knight. There was no way he could catch up with us. I looked back and saw him standing on the shore looking stupid. He wasn't even going to try and catch up. My attention went from getting away from the knight to surviving the river. You know when you first jump into the ocean, you get a jolt of cold, but then your body quickly adapts and you get used to it? Well, not here. The river water was too cold for that. It felt like my body was actually freezing stiff. But I had to fight it, because we were in rapid white water, and that meant there were rocks. I heard once that if you're caught in rapids like this, the best thing to do is point your feet downriver and go with it until you hit a calm patch where you can swim to the side. That was the plan. But Lore was making it tricky. She held on to me so tightly that I was having trouble moving my arms to maneuver. I had to get away from her, or we'd both drown.
"Feet first!" I yelled. "Float on your back!"
I tried to push away, but Lore wouldn't back off. Then she said the three words I never expected to hear from this macho warrior girl. They were the three worst words you could hear in this situation. But she said them just the same.
"I cannot swim!"
Oh, great. No wonder she was clinging to me. This was bad. The river was swirling us around, and every time we hit a drop, both our heads went under. Each time we came up sputtering, and I didn't know how long our luck would hold out. I had to take control somehow, or we were going to drown, or bash our heads into a rock and then drown. I thought maybe we could make a train with both of us on our backs. She'd go feet first, and I'd cradle her from underneath, while using my arms to guide us like a rudder.
"Feet down river!" I shouted. "Face up! Lie on me!"
She didn't move. She couldn't. It wasn't that she didn't want to. It was because she was paralyzed with fear. I can't imagine what it's like not being able to swim, but it must be terrifying. And with her strength, there was no way I could pry myself loose. We hit another drop and both went under again. No sooner did we come up for air than we both slammed into a rock. I barely felt it because Lore took most of the hit with her back. It must have been crushing because it made her loosen her grip on me. Instantly, I grabbed her and flipped her onto her back.
"Grab my legs!"
I commanded. She did. I was on my back too, with Lore between my legs. My arms were now free to steer and keep us afloat. My train idea was working. Now, if we could only ride this out until the rapids stopped.
"Use your legs to keep us off the rocks," I said.
Lore was scared, but she had enough of a grip to start thinking again. While I paddled frantically, she kicked us away from a few sharp rocks. We then hit another drop and went under again. I could feel Lore starting to squirm away from me, but I held her tight with my legs. In a few seconds, we were above water again. Then I was hit with a terrifying thought. What if these rapids led to a waterfall? There was no way we could survive that. I had to force the idea out of my head because there was nothing I could do about it now. We hit a few more drops, bounced off another rock or two, and then mercifully, the river grew calm. We made it through the rapids, and there was no waterfall waiting. But we weren't safe yet, because Lore still couldn't swim. My junior lifeguard training took over at this point, and I began to tow her to the side. She was so tired and beaten that she didn't have enough strength left to fight me, so it wasn't all that tough to bring her along. Soon we were dragging ourselves out of the freezing water and crawling up onto the bank. We lay down on the gravel, totally exhausted, totally beaten up, but alive. Luckily, the three suns were now higher in the sky, and they were starting to give off some warmth. After I caught my breath, I sat up on my elbows and looked at Lore. She lay flat on her back, still breathing hard. I have to admit, now that we were safe, I was feeling pretty good about myself. Not only did I save the big, bad warrior girl from one of Kagan's knights, I also saved her life a dozen times over on the river. I couldn't wait for her to admit that I wasn't the lame wad she thought I was. But of course I wasn't going to fish for a compliment. That wouldn't have been cool. It had to come from her. So I waited. And waited. And waited some more. But she didn't say a word. What was up with that? I was getting kind of ticked off. Not that I was expecting a full-on, "Oh, Pendragon, you're my hero," but a simple thank you would have been nice. Still, there was nothing. Finally, I decided to break the ice. "You okay?" I asked. "No thanks to you," came the reply. "What?" I shouted and sat up straight. "I saved you from drowning." "But if we had not been in the river, I would not have needed help," she said, as if she were totally ticked off at me. "But if we weren't in the river, we would have been attacked by Kagan's knight," I shot back. Lore finally sat up and looked at me. She didn't say anything at first, but her hard look made me feel like some sort of lower life form. "You were hiding in the bushes watching me," she said. Gulp. Busted. "If you had come out to speak with me," she went on, "I would have told you that I was waiting for that night." Huh? I couldn't get my mind around this. "You were waiting for one of Kagan's knights?" I asked, dumbfounded. "Why?" "Because he is the traveler from Denderon, and he was coming to give me information about Press. You nearly killed us both to escape from the most important friend we have here on this territory. What am I supposed to say to you, Pendragon? Thank you?"
Journal number 2. Continued. Denderon.
I had reached a new low. The more I learned about this world, the less I understood. Worse, when I finally tried to take action, I screwed up. Lore and I nearly died on that river, and it was my fault. I wanted to go home. I wanted to be in my bed. I wanted to feel Marley's nose nudging me and smell her fishy dog breath. Instead, I was lying cold and bruised on the bank of a river on the other side of the universe.
"Lore, are you all right?"
I heard the voice first, then saw the guy crashing through the woods. It was the knight who scared me into our whitewater adventure. As he appeared from out of the brush, I could see that he wasn't much older than me. He was tall, and the leather armor made him look even bigger. He wasn't very agile, though. The other knights I saw were trained, dangerous dudes, kind of like ancient marines. This guy had the gear and the look, but he acted more like a big puppy who was all floppy arms and legs. He wasn't exactly the fighting machine one would expect. He stumbled out of the woods, tripped over a root, nearly did a face plant in the dirt, then looked at us with wide, frightened eyes.
"We are fine," assured Lore.
"This was my fault,"
whined the knight,
I am so sorry.
Lore felt herself for broken bones.
Pendragon, she said, this is Alder.
Alder what? I asked, though I think I already knew the answer.
Just Alder,
answered the knight.
Yep.
Another one-name guy. When does a society progress far enough to start using two names? Whatever.
I cannot tell you how happy we are that you have arrived, Pendragon,
said Alder enthusiastically.
Now we can begin.
Uh-oh. What did he mean by begin? I was getting sick of being one step behind everybody else. Begin what? I asked. Alder looked at Lore like he was surprised I didn't know what he was talking about. He should get used to it. I looked at Lore, too. Obviously, they hadn't told me everything. Lore gazed across the river. I could tell she was debating whether or not to answer. Her jaw was clenching. She looked back to me, stared me down for a second, and then let it out.
You have seen how the Bedouin tribe treats the Milago, she began. There is more you have not seen. There is torture and starvation and disease. The Bedouin treat the Milago worse than dogs. They do not have enough food or medicine. Half of the babies born do not live past the first few months. The Glaze mines claim lives every day. If this horrible treatment is not stopped, the Milago will die out. The time has come to stop it.
I didn't like where this was going. Sure, these people had it pretty rough and things needed to change, but what I didn't get was what my part was supposed to be in all this. I wasn't so sure I wanted to know either.
Alder said, "The Milago are a gentle people. They are not warriors. It has taken years of hardship to convince them to take action. If it were not for Press, they may never have been ready."
"What's Uncle Press got to do with it?" I asked.
"Press has been their inspiration," said Alder with reverence. "He has given the Milago the strength to fight back."
Things were happening fast. This was the first time I heard the word fight, and I didn't like it.
"What about you?" I asked Alder. "You're not a Milago, you're a Bedouin. How come you're so concerned about them?"
Lore stared me right in the eye.
"He is a traveler, Pendragon," she said forcefully. "Just like I am, and Press, and my mother. That is what travelers do. They provide help where it is needed. Are you ready for that responsibility?"
"Well, no," I said honestly.
"I did not think so," spat Lore with disgust.
Alder gazed at me with a look of confusion, and maybe a little desperation.
"But Press has spoken of you for some time now," he insisted. "He told us that if anything happened to him, you would take his place."
"Whoa, whoa," I said, backing away from him. "Uncle Press didn't fill me in on any of this. All he said was that there were some people in trouble who needed our help. I figured all we had to do was give somebody a ride someplace or maybe help move some furniture. I didn't know he was talking about leading some freaking revolution." Lore spun to me with fire in her eyes.
"That is the word exactly," she said with passion. "Revolution. The Milago have been preparing to revolt against the Bedouin. Press has made them believe they can succeed. Without him, they will not have the strength to fight, and they will all die. I do not know why, but he has made the Milago believe that you are able to lead them as he would. That is why you are here, Pendragon. That is what you must do."
I felt like I was in the river again, being swept along with no control. My heart was beating about as fast as it had in the river, too. "I'm not a revolutionary, Mark. The closest I ever came to being in a fight was the time you and I wrestled over who was going to bat first and wiffle ball. That doesn't exactly qualify me to lead a revolution."
"Look," I said, trying hard not to let my voice crack.
"I feel bad for these people and all, but I'm not up to this. You say I'm a traveler? Fine, whatever. But up until 2 days ago, I had no idea any of this even existed. How can I suddenly lead a revolution?"
"But you must," said Alder seriously. "The Milago believe that you will take over for Press."
"Then go get Uncle Press," I shouted. Alder then looked down at the ground. Obviously something was wrong.
"Where is Press now?" she demanded.
Alder kept his eyes on the ground and said,
"He is being held in the Bedouin fortress. Kagan has sentenced him to death. He will be executed tomorrow at the equinox.
Oh, man. Uncle Press was going to die? Could things get any worse?
Lore spun away from Alder and picked up a rock. With a roar of anger, she reached back and threw it across the river. It was like she was channeling her anger and frustration into this one mighty throw. She stormed toward me like an enraged bull. I took a few steps back, expecting her to take a swing at me. But she didn't. Instead, she stuck her nose in my face and seethed.
I do not understand why Press believes in you. You are a coward. You are weak, and you do not care for anyone but yourself. But you are a traveler, and you will begin to act like one. It is time you saw the truth.
And with that, she gave me a shove backward. I had to pinwheel my arms to keep from falling over. Alder said meekly,
"You know I cannot go with you."
"I know," answered Lore. "Meet us after dark."
She gave me another shove and walked off. I didn't know what else to do, so I followed her. We didn't say much on our walk back to the Malago village, and it gave me a chance to digest all that I had just learned. I guess that travelers are some kind of cosmic do-gooders. Well, that's very noble and all, but I didn't volunteer for this particular honor. Just the opposite. I didn't want any part of it. Everyone kept telling me that I was a traveler and that I had a responsibility, but who the heck made me a traveler? I don't remember signing up. Maybe it's like the army where you get drafted, but if I were the guy in charge of drafting travelers, I sure as heck wouldn't pick somebody like me. They should have picked a Navy SEAL or a SWAT guy, or better still, one of those WWF muscleheads. They shouldn't have picked a 14-year-old gym rat. Even if I wanted to help the Malago, the second I opened my mouth, they'd know I was a fraud. No. The best thing I could do was stick to Plan A, and that was to get to the flume and get out of here ASAP. There was one thing that bothered me, though. Uncle Press was in trouble. No, worse. He was going to die the next day. But what could I do? If I went after him, Kagan's knights would cut me to ribbons and we'd both be dead. I was in a horrible situation. When Laura and I got back to the village, we were greeted by Osa, who looked at us with concern. My guess is she could tell that things were going badly. Before Osa could ask what had happened, Lore said,
"He must see the mines."
Osa didn't ask why. She just looked at her daughter and gave a weary sigh.
"Come with me, Pendragon,"
said Osa, and started to walk off.
"What if I don't want to see the mines?"
I asked. "Because I didn't." Osa looked at me with these intense, piercing eyes. She wasn't scolding me. She wasn't trying to intimidate me either. This is hard to describe, but the look she gave me was one of absolute certainty. The look said, "You will come and see the mines because that is what you must do." Maybe it was a kind of hypnotism, but the instant she looked at me, I knew I had no choice. So I followed her. Weird, huh? Lore didn't come with us, and Osa didn't invite her. It was just the two of us, and that was fine by me. As we walked through the Malago village, I started to notice something I hadn't seen before. Whenever we passed one of the Malago, they would give me a quick glance. We'd make eye contact, and then they'd quickly look to the ground and continue on their way. It was weird. It was like they were watching me, but afraid to acknowledge that I was there. Up until now, I thought they didn't even know I existed. Nobody talked to anyone else, and they certainly didn't talk to me. That is, of course, except for Figgis. He was the only Malago who spoke to me. Everybody else kept to themselves. Yet here they were, checking me out. I was betting these villagers were looking at me and thinking, "How can this be the guy who's going to lead our revolution? He's a wussy kid." And they were right. I followed Osa back to the path that led to the ocean. We walked a few yards into the woods, and I saw that there was another, smaller path that led off to the right. This is the path we took, and it led us to a clearing where there was a large foundation made of stone. It looked much like the stage in the center of the village where the transfer ceremony took place, but there was no wooden platform covering it. There was a huge wooden frame built over the foundation with a large pulley attached. A thick rope looped over the pulley and dropped down into the hole.
two burly men were hauling on the rope, bringing up something from below. The setup kind of reminded me of one of those old-fashioned wishing wells where the bucket would be dropped down on a rope and then hoisted out with water. But in this case, they weren't hoisting up water. They were hoisting up glaze. The two men brought the large basket to the surface, grabbed it, and emptied it onto the ground. A few craggy glaze stones tumbled out. The two looked at each other and sighed. Apparently, this wasn't a very good haul. I remembered that they had to bring out enough glaze to balance with the wife of the man who was killed the day before. They added the new stones to a larger pile next to the foundation. There wasn't much there. If they didn't bring up more glaze, the poor woman would join her husband at the bottom of the pit. A cold chill went up my spine. Osa walked to the foundation, sat down, and swung her legs over the side.
"Be careful," she commanded.
And with that, she lowered herself over the side. Where was she going? Did she jump? I walked up to the edge, looked down, and saw that there was a ladder attached to the side. Osa was climbing down into what looked like a bottomless pit. In no time, she disappeared into the gloom. I looked over at the two miners. Sure enough, they were looking at me. But the second we made eye contact, they looked away and went back to work. I'm not sure what was creepier, knowing that everyone was checking me out, or climbing down a rickety ladder into the dark unknown.
"Now, Pendragon!"
echoed Osa's voice from below. I reached over the side and tugged on the ladder to make sure it was sturdy. I swung my legs over, grabbed the ladder, and started down. It was a good thing the pit was dark, because if I could have seen all the way to the bottom, I'm not sure I would have had the guts to climb down. The ladder itself was crudely made from saplings lashed together, but it was strong. After climbing down several feet, I found that the foot of the ladder rested on a stone ledge, but this wasn't the bottom. The top of another ladder was leaning on the ledge next to this one, and since Osa wasn't there, I figured I had to climb down it as well. In all, there were 15 ladders. Unbelievable! This pit was deep. Every third ledge had a tunnel that led horizontally away from the pit. I figured that these were abandoned sections of the mine. Probably when the glaze ran out on each level, they would tunnel deeper and deeper and deeper. Finally, I reached the bottom, where Osa stood waiting for me. There was light down here, too. Small candles were everywhere. It wasn't exactly bright, but once my eyes adjusted, I could see just fine. There was one tunnel leading away from the pit, and that's where Osa went. I followed her obediently. The tunnel was carved out of the rock. I could stand up straight, but Osa had to crouch down a bit. It was a good thing I wasn't claustrophobic.
"The main shaft was built generations ago," she explained. "But when they discovered a rich vein of glaze at this level, the miners decided to do things differently."
"What did they do?" I asked. Osa didn't have to answer. After a few more yards, the tunnel emptied out into a humongous cavern. The ceiling must have been 30 feet high. It was spectacular. Leading off from the cavern were many other tunnels. It was like we were at the center of a wagon wheel, and the tunnels, like spokes, led out from the center in all directions. Down each tunnel was a set of miniature tracks. I had seen pictures of gold mines before, and I figured these tracks were for the ore cars.
"Once it was discovered that this was the level to find glaze, the tunneling started to spread out in all directions," she explained. "There are miles and miles of tunnels. It is so complex that miners have lost their way and wandered for days."
I had to admit, it was pretty impressive, especially because these guys did all of the work by hand. We stood to the side of the cavern and watched the activity. There were no powerful mining machines here, just the strong backs of Malago miners. Some were pushing carts full of dirt, others emptied the carts in the center of the cavern and sifted it for bits of glaze. I also heard the distant sound of pickaxes ringing against stone as the miners labored to stretch the tunnels in their search for more glaze.
"The miners work day and night," Osa explained. It is the only way they can possibly meet Kagan's unreasonable demands.
She reached down and picked up one of the miner's tools. It was a metal pickaxe with a wooden handle.
"These tools are forbidden on the surface because they are made of metal," she told me. "The penalty for using a metal tool on the surface is death."
Now that she mentioned it, I didn't remember seeing anything made of metal on the surface. All the tools that were used above were made from wood or from stone. It was like the Bedouin were trying to keep the Malago back in the Stone Age, except for when it came to getting their precious glaze, of course. I began to notice that there was an odd smell to the mine. It wasn't a horrible smell. In fact, it was kind of sweet.
"What is that smell?" I asked.
Osa didn't answer, but motioned for me to follow her. We walked across the large cavern, stepping across the railroad tracks. As we approached the far side, I began to make out something that made me shudder. I hadn't seen it before because the light was so dim, but now that we were here, I could see things plainly. To be honest, I wished I still couldn't see, but I did. Lying on the floor of the cavern were dozens of miners. They looked horrible. Some moaned in pain. Others just sat there with blank looks.
"They look sick," I said.
"They are,"
came the sad reply.
"The smell is a gas that is released when the glaze is separated from the rock. It is a poison that slowly destroys your ability to breathe."
"We're breathing toxic fumes?" I asked, ready to bolt back to the ladders.
"Do not worry," she said calmly. "You must breathe it for years for it to be of concern."
I looked at the sick miners and said, "These guys have been breathing it for years?" Osa nodded sadly.
"It is a painful death."
"Why don't they go up into the fresh air?" I asked with horror.
"They have no strength left,"
was the grim answer.
"These poor souls are in the final stages of the disease. They will die here."
I took a few steps back from the sick miners. I'm ashamed to admit it, but I was afraid I might catch this nasty disease from them. Suddenly the huge cavern didn't seem so huge anymore. The walls felt like they were closing in, and I wanted out of there in a bad way. Maybe I had a touch of claustrophobia after all. "Why did you have to show me this?" I demanded to know.
"Because it is very important that you understand how desperate the situation is for the Malago," Osa said.
I wanted to scream. Osa was setting me up. She was showing me how bad these guys had it, so I'd feel sorry for them and agree to lead their revolution. But why? Osa didn't seem like a fool. She could see that I wasn't the kind of guy who could lead a revolution. Her daughter figured it out pretty quick. Why wasn't Osa with the program? I didn't want to argue here in front of these poor miners, so I headed for the tunnel that led to the ladders.
"Where are you going?"
she asked. "Home," was my simple reply. I hurried across the cavern, hopping over the railroad tracks and dodging the ore cars. Then, just as I was about to enter the tunnel that led to the ladders, somebody ran in front of me. It was Figgis. But this time, he didn't stop to try and sell me something. He was in a hurry, and I'm not even sure he knew it was me who he cut off. I watched the little guy run down the tunnel toward the ladders and was about to follow him when I felt the ground start to shudder. Uh-oh. Was this an earthquake? Or a cave-in? A second later, there was a huge explosion. I spun to look where the sound came from and saw black smoke billowing out from one of the tunnels. Many of the miners were looking at the smoking tunnel with confusion. Now, I'm no expert, but these guys have been doing this mining thing for a long time. Surely they had been through an explosion like this before. You'd think that they would have instantly kicked into emergency gear and either evacuated the mine or started damage control. There could be miners trapped in there who needed to be rescued. But that's not what happened. The miners just looked to each other with a mixture of fear and confusion. It was like they didn't know what to do. Finally, Osa called out, "Are there men in there?" One of the miners shouted out, "Relin!" This seemed to wake the others up. They quickly came to their senses and headed for the smoking tunnel to rescue their leader. one of the miners tied a rope around his waist, boldly fought the smoke, and entered the tunnel. Another few miners held the other end of the rope. I guess the idea was that if he passed out, they could drag him back to safety. Brave guy. The ground didn't shake again. Whatever damage the explosion caused was only in that one tunnel. I didn't feel I was in any danger, and I wanted to stay and see if Relan was okay.
How often do they have explosions like that? I asked.
Osa kept staring at the smoking tunnel, and then said something I never expected to hear.
What is an explosion?
She asked.
Huh? How could she not know what an explosion was? This woman knew everything there was to know.
It couldn't have been a language thing because travelers understood all languages.
You know, I continued, explosion? That big bang, from dynamite or something.
Osa looked at me with confusion and said,
I have never seen anything like that happen here, nor in my home territory. You are saying that loud noise caused the damage? Like lightning?
This was deeply weird. Though maybe it explained why the miners reacted the way they did. They probably had no idea what happened either.
But then what had caused the explosion?
Maybe they tapped into some underground gas pocket. Before we could talk more about it, the miners, holding the rope, began to frantically pull on their end. Other miners gathered to watch with concern. They stared into the smoky tunnel, waiting to see what came out. After a few seconds, the miner on the other end emerged from the smoke, and in his arms was Relan. The chief miner was full of black soot, and there were traces of blood around his forehead, but he was okay. Dazed, but okay. He was helped to sit down and brought a leather skin full of water to drink. Relan took a long drink, swished it in his mouth, and spit. Then an odd thing happened. Relan looked up at the other miners, gazing at each one in turn, and began to laugh. The other miners didn't know what to make of this. Maybe the total relief from his brush with death came out in nervous laughter, or maybe he was crazy. I sure didn't know, and from the confused looks of the miners, they didn't know either. I have to admit, it was kind of creepy. I think Osa felt the same way because she put a hand on my shoulder and said,
"We should go to the surface."
She didn't have to tell me twice. I was down that tunnel and up those ladders in an instant. As I climbed, I looked up at the circle of blue sky that grew larger and larger the higher I got. It was the light at the end of a long, dark tunnel, and I couldn't get to it fast enough. When I poked my head out into the fresh air, I took a deep breath and promised myself that I would never go down in that hellhole again. One of the miners who hoisted up the basket of glaze was leaning against the wooden frame of the pulley system, watching me. The other miner was gone. Then I sensed something strange. For some reason, the miner didn't turn away after we made eye contact. He kept on staring at me. Osa poked up out of the hole, jumped onto the ground, and said,
"Tell me more about this thing you call explosion."
Before I could answer, Osa's attention was caught by something behind me. I turned to look and saw the miner who had been staring at me. Osa walked past me with her eyes fixed on the man. He just stood there, still looking at me with a dumb expression on his face. Osa walked right up to him, stared at him for a moment more, then quickly spun back toward me and shouted, "Pendragon, run!"
Huh?
Before Osa could say another word, the miner toppled over and fell at her feet. My eyes fixed on the wooden arrow that was sticking out of his back.
Yeah, the guy was dead. That wasn't a dumb look on his face. It was a dead look. I had never seen a dead man before. I couldn't move.
Osa ran to me, grabbed my hand, and started to drag me toward the forest. We had only gone a few steps when four of Kagan's knights leaped out in front of us. Now I knew what had happened to the miner.
"We've come for the boy," they announced.
There was no mistaking it this time. Unlike the knight named Alder, who I mistook for an enemy back by the river, these guys were not on our side. They carried club-like weapons, and, judging from the poor dead miner with the arrow sticking out of his back, they wouldn't hesitate to use them for whatever mayhem they thought fit. Osa didn't move. but I could feel her tense up. She let go of my hand and slowly turned sideways. I knew what this meant. It was exactly what we were taught to do in karate class. Turning sideways made you a smaller target. Yeah, there was going to be a fight, and I was in the middle of it. Osa wasn't about to make the first move. She was too smart for that. If something was going to happen, it would be the knights who would start it. One raised his club and took a step toward us. I froze. Osa bent her knees, ready to defend herself. The knight let out a bellow, began to charge, and whack! He suddenly went down in a heap as if he had been shot. The other knights were just as surprised as I was, but I saw the reason for it before they did. Standing behind them was Lore, holding her wooden stave. Nice shot! She had another weapon and quickly tossed it to her mother. Osa caught it and crouched into attack mode. Now they were both armed, and the odds became a little better. But still, these knights were professional fighters. I wasn't so sure how these warrior women would do against them. Things happened fast. Before the knights could recover from the surprise of seeing their buddy do a face plant, Lore grabbed the club from the hand of the knight she had just whacked, and in one quick movement, she threw it to me. I caught it just as Lore took up position next to her mother. It was now 3-on-3. Well, 2.5-on-3, because the chances of me using that club to attack one of those hairy knights were about the same as me sprouting wings and flying out of there. "Fight, Pendragon," commanded Lore. At that instant, the three knights charged. Osa and Lore ran to meet them. I stood frozen. My prediction about Osa and Lore being warriors turned out to be 100% correct. These two were awesome. They swung their long wooden weapons like martial arts experts. If I weren't so terrified, I probably would have enjoyed the show. They spun and twirled the long staves so quickly they were nothing more than blurs. The knights, on the other hand, fought awkwardly. They would swing their clubs, but the women would either bat the attack away with a deft flip of their stave or dodge out of the way and answer the attack with a ringing smack to the body. If this were a toe-to-toe slugfest, I would have bet on the knights. But Osa and Lore never stood still long enough for the knights to get a solid shot at them. It was like watching lumbering bears being attacked by vicious bees, and the bees were winning! The only problem was that the knights were armored. It was going to take more than a few defensive blows to stop these guys, but I was certain that Osa and Lore were going to take care of them, so I began to relax. Bad move. That's when one of the knights charged me. He had his club held high and screamed like he was getting up the energy to take my head off. I didn't know what to do. I should have held out the club to protect myself. I should have ducked and then attacked. I should have thrown the club at him to slow him up. But I didn't do any of those things. All I did was take a few steps back in fear, trip, and fall down on my butt. I was dead meat. The knight was almost on me. I could see the rage in his eyes. This was going to hurt. A few more steps, and he would be within swinging range. But then, Osa threw her wooden stave at the guy like a javelin, and it hit him right in the knees. His legs buckled, and he fell to the ground, hard. Lore was on him instantly. She gave him a ringing whack with her stave, and the knight crumpled unconscious. Two down! Lore looked at me, and I could see the fire of battle in her eyes. "Fight, you coward!" she commanded. Osa ran up and shouted, "No! Take him! Hide him!" Lore wanted to stay and fight beside her mother, but Osa was in charge. "He must not be taken! Go!" commanded Osa. There wasn't time for argument, because the other two knights were back on the attack. Reluctantly, Lore grabbed me by the arm and yanked me to my feet. "I have to tell you, Mark, I never felt so helpless and embarrassed in my life. I was a complete wuss. You always wonder how you might react in times of danger. You always have these visions that you'll rise to the occasion and be the hero and save the day. Well, let me tell you, that fantasy couldn't be any further from the truth than what was happening to me. I'm ashamed to admit it, but I was like a frightened baby." As Lore pulled me away toward the forest, I glanced back to see what was happening with Osa. What I saw was incredible. She was even better on her own. this amazing warrior woman fought both knights at the same time. She spun, thrust, parried, and rarely missed the mark. It seemed almost easy. Lore and I dove out of the clearing into the woods, then turned back and hid to watch the endgame. I knew that Lore wanted to be in there fighting beside her mother. It was killing her to be here, babysitting me. "Your mother is amazing," I whispered to Lore. Lore didn't comment, but I knew she felt the same way. A few moments later, it was all over. The knights had been losing steam, and after a few more ringing blows, they both collapsed to the ground, either unconscious or too exhausted to move. Osa remained in a crouch and swept the air with a quick 360 to be sure the fight was over. She then straightened up, spun her wooden stave like a ninja master, and slipped it into its leather strap that ran across her back. The battle had been won.
"You don't deserve this, Pendragon," Lore spat at me.
She was right. I didn't. These two women had risked their lives for me, and there was no way I was capable of living up to what they expected of me in return. But as bad as I felt, the real horror of the situation hadn't yet hit. Lore and I stood up and started back into the clearing. Osa saw us. She took a few steps toward us, then suddenly stopped. Lore saw this and quickly put her hand out to stop me as well. Something was wrong. Were the knights waking up? I looked at Osa, who slowly returned to her fighting stance. She was back on full alert and started to reach for her wooden stave. I looked around the clearing, but there was no movement at all. The knights lay unconscious where they had fallen. Why was everyone so tense? A second later, I had my answer. A moment that will forever haunt me. I first heard a rustling and thought someone was coming through the bushes. I soon learned it wasn't in the bushes. It was coming from above. It was in the trees. I looked up and saw to my horror that perched up in the trees were four more knights. These knights weren't armed with clubs. They had bows and arrows. I had forgotten that the miner was killed with an arrow. These knights had been there the whole time watching the spectacle, and now they were about to make their move. Osa stood in the middle of the clearing, unprotected. Lore was about to run to her, but Osa yelled out, "Hide him!" This made Lore stop. It must have taken every bit of willpower to go against her instincts and obey her mother, but that's what she did. She backed off, grabbed my hand, and that's when it started. The knights let loose with their arrows, all aimed at Osa. The brave woman wore no armor. There was nothing to protect her from this deadly rain. All four arrows hit their mark, and Osa crumpled to her knees. Lore let out a pained little sound and started to run for her, but I grabbed her. By now the knights had already reloaded, and if Lore had run to her mother, she would have met the same deadly fate. We stood there for a second, looking into the doomed woman's kind eyes. Maybe I was imagining things, but as I write this now, I could swear that she gave us a little smile. The knights unleashed another volley of arrows, but these weren't meant for Osa. These were aimed at us. Luckily, we were protected by trees, and they all ended up missing us or slamming into branches. But it was enough to throw Lore back into action. She grabbed my hand and off we ran into the forest, leaving behind her mortally wounded mother. Lore knew the forest well. Keeping up with her was like running with a deer. She leaped over fallen trees, skirted boulders, and blasted through a thicket. We weren't going in a straight line either, and I realized that this journey was all about shaking the knights who might be trailing us. I was getting tired and had a nasty stitch in my side, but there was no way I would complain. Not after what these women had done for me. We eventually made our way around to the far side of the village, where Lore brought me to a stone hut. I wasn't exactly thrilled with her choice of hiding places. All it would take for a knight to find us was a quick search of the village. But I soon found out that Lore had other things in mind. She quickly dove on the pile of animal skins that was lying along one wall and pulled them aside. Beneath was the same hard-packed earth that all the hut floors were made of. Lore took her wooden stave and started to scratch at the dirt. With a couple of quick digs, she unearthed a wooden ring. She threw her stave down, grabbed the ring, and pulled. It was a trap door.
"This leads to the mines," she said in explanation.
Oh, great! I had promised myself never to return to those mines. It was a promise that lasted a good 20 minutes.
"The Bedouin are afraid of the gas," she said. "They never go into the mines."
She threw open the trap door to reveal another crude ladder leading down.
"Here we go again."
She motioned for me to go first. Lore followed quickly and closed the door behind her. We climbed down only one ladder. It led to a small tunnel that we had to crouch down in to walk along. I could tell that it was angled downward.
"There are many of these small tunnels," she said. "They bring air to the miners."
So basically, we were walking along a ventilation shaft. Made sense. But since this was only for ventilation, there were no candles to show us the way. It was like walking through ink. I kept one hand out in front of me in case a wall decided to jump out. But I wasn't going fast enough for Lore. She barged ahead and took the lead. She moved much faster, and it was easier to follow her than it was to follow nothing. I just hoped she knew where she was going. This ventilation tunnel led to a much wider tunnel with some ore car tracks. I figured this must have been one of the early mining tunnels that was dug before the Malago built the big cavern. We followed this tunnel for several minutes until it emptied out into a familiar space. It was the mine shaft where Osa and I first climbed down.
When was that?
It felt like a century ago, but it was more like an hour. We came out on one of the rock ledges, and I saw that we were only 3 levels down from the surface. The familiar circle of blue light beckoned from above. Lore stood out on the ledge and looked up. She was obviously debating with herself about something, and it didn't take long for me to find out what it was.
"Go to the bottom," she commanded. "I will meet you there. Go!"
She stared at me until I started to climb down the ladder. As soon as I started down, she began to climb up.
Just as I figured. She wanted to go to her mother.
I hung on the ladder and watched her climb to the surface. I know I should have kept going down, as I was told, but I couldn't. Osa had put her life on the line for me, and I had to find out how she was. So, after wrestling with the decision for a few seconds, I started to climb up. When I reached the last ladder before the surface, I heard something coming from outside. I didn't know what it was at first, and when I finally recognized it, it made my heart sink. It was Lore. She was humming the same sweet song that I'd heard her humming by the river. I pulled myself up out of the mine shaft, and what I saw then broke my heart. Lore was sitting on the ground next to the stone foundation. She cradled Osa's head in her lap and stroked her hair while slowly rocking back and forth, as if lulling a baby to sleep. I didn't know if Osa was dead or alive. Lying next to her were the 4 arrows that had hit her. Lore had pulled them out. I stayed where I was because I didn't want to intrude. Lore was a proud girl, and I was sure she wouldn't want me to see her cry. I glanced around the clearing and saw that the knights were gone. The archers in the trees probably dragged off their unconscious buddies. The body of the Malago miner was still there, though. He lay on his back, staring up sightlessly into the sky. That's when I saw Osa's hand move. She reached out weakly and took her daughter's hand. She was alive! I quickly ran over to see if I could be of any help. Lore didn't acknowledge that I was there, except that she stopped humming her song. But Osa knew I was there, and she looked up at me with tired eyes.
"Do not be sad,"
she said with a weak voice.
"Either of you, this
is the way it was meant to be.
I had trouble holding back my tears. Osa wasn't going to make it.
I'm sorry, Osa.